listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Community Living Show here on the NCRA Radio Network's national broadcast of National Radio and Campus Community Radio programmings here on this station. Of course, our station is CITR 101.9 FM for the full hour. I'm, of course, Kelly, and joining me is Michael Rubin. How's it going?
Good morning, Kelly. It's going pretty well. The commute wasn't too bad in today.
So, yep.
And we finally got the video up to the GoFundMe for the Fibromyalgia Wellspring Foundation.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
You've got the video and everything that was all clipped in and everything.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's all in there now. And maybe we can play that a little bit later on.
Okay, sounds good.
So
I'm just fixing up here some stuff for a little bit.
So that's one of the things that it's a lot of fun, you know, working with people with their crowd funds, you know, doing mm-hmm. these videos and everything. So it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And you get to hear a lot of stories, and you some of the things that we broadcast here, you know, mm-hmm. advocacy for people with any type of disability, rather mm-hmm. it's obvious or hidden. You hear the stories of people still do discriminate a lot, you know, mm-hmm. or make prejudgments or things like that. And it's like,
right.
So, you know, in... Hopefully, we're doing a lot to make some of that go away, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, it looks like you're searching for a selection for today?
Yes, I am. So, we'll do a speech from the speeches.
While you're looking for that, next week's show, we will have a group called the Sense Afloat. Mm-hmm. And they have some really valuable information about, I remember them like years ago when I was a kid being called deprivation tanks,
mm-hmm.
where they, you're just kind of isolated in this tank of fluid. And, now they're calling them float tanks or, but there's some serious pain relief benefits from them, and mm-hmm. we're going to have these guys come on, and they're going to tell us, one, how they got started in this whole thing, and two, what are some of the really health benefits that go along with mm-hmm. Using a float spa. So
float spa.
Yeah. Mm,
interesting.
Yep. You're... Well, they'll get into more detail about it, but you're floating in the tank with magnesium salt in it. So it's pretty interesting.
So, you interested in some sort of TED Talks?
Sure.
Okay, so this one is about... Oh, hang on a moment here. This one is about, do schools kill creativity? Sir Ken Robinson talks about the entertaining and profoundly moving cases of creating of education system and nurtures creativity. So, want to check that out?
Let's check it out.
All right. We'll be back.
Good morning. How are you? It's been great, hasn't it? I've been blown away by the whole thing. In fact, I'm leaving. There have been three themes, haven't there, running through the conference, which are relevant to what I want to talk about. One is the extraordinary evidence of human creativity in all of the presentations that we've had and in all the people here. Just the variety of it and the range of it. The second is that it's put us in a place where we have no idea what's going to happen in terms of the future. No idea how this may play out. I have an interest in education. Actually, what I find is everybody has an interest in education, don't you? I find this very interesting. If you're at a dinner party and you say you work in education, actually, you're not often at dinner parties, frankly, if you work in education, you're not asked, you know, and and you're never asked back, curiously. That's a thing that strikes me. But if you are, and you say to somebody, they say, what do you do? And you say, you work in education, you can see the blood run from their face. They think, oh, my God, you know, why me? It's my one night out all week. But if you ask people about their education, they pin you to the wall. Because it's one of those things that goes deep with people. Am I right? Like religion and money and other things. So I have a big interest in education, and I think we all do. We have a huge vested interest in it, partly because it's education that's meant to take us into this future that we can't grasp. If you think of it, children starting school this year will be retiring in 2065. Nobody has a clue, despite all the expertise that's been on parade for the past 4 days, what the world will look like in 5 years' time. And yet we're meant to be educating them for it. So the unpredictability, I think, is extraordinary. And the third part of this is that we've all agreed, nonetheless, on the really extraordinary capacities that children have, their capacities for innovation. I mean, Serena last night was a marvel, wasn't she? Just seeing what she could do. And she's exceptional, but I think she's not, so to speak, exceptional in the whole of childhood. What you have there is a person of extraordinary dedication who found a talent. And my contention is all kids have tremendous talents, and we squander them pretty ruthlessly. So I want to talk about education, and I want to talk about creativity. My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. Thank you. That was it, by the way. Thank you very much. So, 15 minutes left. Well, I was born. No, the. I had a great story recently. I love telling it. Of a little girl who was in a drawing lesson. She was six, and she was at the back drawing. And the teacher said, "This little girl hardly ever paid attention." And in this drawing lesson, she did. And the teacher was fascinated. She went over to her and she said, "What are you drawing?" And the girl said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And the teacher said, "But nobody knows what God looks like." And the girl said, "They will in a minute." When my son was four in England, actually, he was four everywhere, to be honest. I mean, if we're being strict about it, wherever he went, he was four that year. But he was in the Nativity play. Do you remember the story? No, it's big. It's a big story. Mel Gibson did the sequel. You may have seen it. I don't know. It was Nativity 2. But James got the part of Joseph, which we were thrilled about. We consider this to be one of the lead parts. We had the place crammed full of agents in T-shirts. You know, James Robinson is Joseph. We had. He didn't have to speak, but do you know the bit where the three kings come in? Now, they come in bearing gifts, and they bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh. This really happened. We were sitting there, and they, I think, just went out of sequence. Because we talked to the little boy afterwards and said, you know, are you okay with that? And they said, yeah, why, was that wrong? They just switched, I think that was it. Anyway, the three boys came in, little four-year-olds with tea towels on their heads, and they put these boxes down. The first boy said, I bring you gold. And the second boy said, I bring you myrrh. And the third boy said, Frank sent this. What these things have in common, you see, is that kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative. What we do know is, if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. And the result is that we are educating people out of their creative capacities. Picasso once said this. He said that all children are born artists. The problem is to remain an artist as we grow up. I believe this passionately, that we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it. So why is this? I lived in Stratford-on-Avon until about 5 years ago. In fact, we moved from Stratford to Los Angeles. So you can imagine what a seamless transition, you know, this was from LA. Actually, we lived in a place called Snitterfield, just outside Stratford, which is where Shakespeare's father was born. Are you struck by a new thought? I was. You don't think of Shakespeare having a father, do you? Do you? Because you don't think of Shakespeare being a child. Do you? Shakespeare being seven. I never thought of it. I mean, he was seven at some point. He was in somebody's English class, wasn't he? Do you understand? Really? How annoying would that be? You know? Must try harder. being sent to bed by his dad, to Shakespeare, go to bed now, you know, to William Shakespeare, you know, and put the pencil down. You know, and stop speaking like that. You know, it's confusing everybody. Anyway, we moved from Stratford to Los Angeles, and I just want to say a word about the transition. Actually, my son didn't want to come. I've got two kids. He's 21 now, and my daughter's 16. He didn't want to come to Los Angeles. He loved it, but he had a girlfriend in England. This was the love of his life, Sarah. He'd known her for a month. Mind you, they'd had their fourth anniversary, because it's a long time when you're 16. Anyway, he was really upset on the plane. He said, I'll never find another girl like Sarah. And we were rather pleased about that, frankly, because she was... she was the main reason we were leaving the country. But something strikes you when you move to America and when you travel around the world. Every education system on Earth has the same hierarchy of subjects. Everyone, doesn't matter where you go. You think it would be otherwise, but it isn't. At the top are mathematics and languages, then the humanities, and the bottom are the arts, everywhere on Earth. And in pretty much every system, too, there's a hierarchy within the arts. Art and music are normally given a higher status in schools than drama and dance. There isn't an education system on the planet that teaches dance every day to children the way we teach them mathematics. Why? Why not? I think this is rather important. I think maths is very important, but so is dance. Children dance all the time, if they're allowed to. We all do. We all have bodies, don't we? You know, did I miss a meeting? I mean, I think... Truthfully, what happens is, as children grow up, we start to educate them progressively from the waist up. And then we focus on their heads, and slightly to one side. If you were to visit education as an alien and say, what's it for, public education, I think you'd have to conclude, if you look at the output, you know, who really succeeds by this? Who does everything they should? Who gets all the brownie points? You know, who are the winners? I think you'd have to conclude the whole purpose of public education throughout the world is to produce university professors. Isn't it? They're the people who come out the top. And I used to be one. So there. You know. But, and I like university professors, but, you know, we shouldn't hold them up as the high watermark of all human achievement. They're just a form of life. You know, another form of life. But they're rather curious, and I say this out of affection for them. There's something curious about professors. In my experience, not all of them, but typically, they live in their heads. They live up there and slightly to one side. They're disembodied, you know, in a kind of literal way. You know, they look upon their body as a form of transport for their heads. You know, it's... Don't they? It's a way of getting their head to meetings. If you want real evidence of out-of-body experiences, by the way, get yourself along to a residential conference for senior academics and pop into the discotheque on the final night. And there you will see it, grown men and women writhing uncontrollably off the beat. Wait until it ends so they can go home and write a paper about it. Now, our education system is predicated on the idea of academic ability. And there's a reason. The whole system was invented around the world. There were no public systems of education really before the 19th century. They all came into being to meet the needs of industrialism. So the hierarchy is rooted on two ideas. Number one, that the most useful subjects for work are at the top. So you were probably steered benignly away from things at school when you were a kid, things you liked, on the grounds you would never get a job doing that. Is that right? Don't do music, you're not going to be a musician. Don't do art, you won't be an artist. Benign advice, now profoundly mistaken. The whole world is engulfed in a revolution. And the second is academic ability, which has really come to dominate our view of intelligence because the universities designed the system in their image. If you think of it, the whole system of public education around the world is a protracted process of university entrance. And the consequence is that many highly talented, brilliant, creative people think they're not, because the thing they were good at school wasn't valued or was actually stigmatized. And I think we can't afford to go on that way. In the next 30 years, according to UNESCO, more people worldwide will be graduating through education than since the beginning of history. More people. And it's the combination of all the things we've talked about, technology and its transformational effect on work, and demography and the huge explosion in population. Suddenly, degrees aren't worth anything. Isn't that true? When I was a student, if you had a degree, you had a job. If you didn't have a job, it's because you didn't want one. And I didn't want one, frankly, so... but now, kids with degrees are often heading home to carry on playing video games because you need an MA, where the previous job required a BA, and now you need a PhD for the other. It's a process of academic inflation, and it indicates the whole structure of education is shifting beneath our feet. We need to radically rethink our view of intelligence. We know three things about intelligence. One, it's diverse. We think about the world in all the ways that we experience it. We think visually, we think in sound, we think kinesthetically, we think in abstract terms, we think in movement. Secondly, intelligence is dynamic. If you look at the interactions of a human brain, as we heard yesterday from a number of presentations, intelligence is wonderfully interactive. The brain isn't divided into compartments. In fact, creativity, which I define as the process of having original ideas that have value, more often than not, comes about through the interaction of different disciplinary ways of seeing things. The brain is intentionally... By the way, there's a shaft of nerves that joins the two halves of the brain called the corpus callosum. It's thicker in women. Following on from Helen yesterday, I think this is probably why women are better at multitasking. Because you are, aren't you? There's a raft of research, but I know it from my personal life. If my wife is cooking a meal at home, which is not often, thankfully, but, you know, if she's doing... she's good at some things. But if she's cooking, you know, she's dealing with people on the phone, she's talking to the kids, she's painting the ceiling, you know, she's doing open-heart surgery over here. If I'm cooking, the door is shut, the kids are out, the phone's on the hook. If she comes in, I get annoyed. I say, Terry, please, I'm trying to fry an egg in here. You know, give me a break. Actually, there was. Do you know that old philosophical thing? If a tree falls in a forest and nobody hears it, did it happen? Remember that old chestnut? I saw a great T-shirt really recently which said, "If a man speaks his mind in a forest and no woman hears him, is he still wrong?" And the third thing about intelligence is it's distinct. I'm doing a new book at the moment called Epiphany, which is based on a series of interviews with people about how they discovered their talent. I'm fascinated by how people got to be there. It's really prompted by a conversation I had with a wonderful woman who most people have never heard of. She's called Gillian Lynn. Have you heard of her? Some have. She's a choreographer, and everybody knows her work. She did Cats and Phantom of the Opera. She's wonderful. I used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet in England, as you can see. And anyway, Gillian and I had lunch one day. I said, how'd you get to be a dancer? And she said it was interesting. When she was at school, she was really hopeless. And the school in the 30s wrote to her parents and said, we think Gillian has a learning disorder. She couldn't concentrate. She was fidgeting. I think now they'd say she had ADHD. Wouldn't you? But this was the 1930s, and ADHD hadn't been invented, you know, at this point. So it wasn't an available condition. You know, people weren't aware they could have that. Anyway, she went to see this specialist. So this oak-paneled room, and she was there with her mother, and she was led and sat on this chair at the end, and she sat on her hands for 20 minutes while this man talked to her mother about all the problems Gillian was having at school. And at the end of it, because she was disturbing people, her homework was always late and so on, little kid of eight, in the end, the doctor went and sat next to Gillian and said, Gillian, I've listened to all these things that your mother's told me. I need to speak to her privately. So she said, he said, wait here, we'll be back. We won't be very long. And they went and left her. But as they went out the room, he turned on the radio that was sitting on his desk. And when they got out the room, he said to her mother, just stand and watch her. And the minute they left the room, she said she was on her feet, moving to the music. And they watched for a few minutes, and he turned to her mother, and he said, you know, Mrs. Lynn, Gillian isn't sick, she's a dancer. Take her to a dance school. I said, what happened? Said she did. I can't tell you how wonderful it was. We walked in this room and it was full of people like me. People who couldn't sit still. People who had to move to think. Who had to move to think. They did ballet, they did tap, they did jazz, they did modern, they did contemporary. She was eventually auditioned for the Royal Ballet School. She became a soloist. She had a wonderful career at the Royal Ballet. She eventually graduated from the Royal Ballet School, found her own company, the Gillian Lynn Dance Company. Met Andrew Lloyd Webber. She's been responsible for some of the most successful musical theatre productions in history. She's given pleasure to millions, and she's a multimillionaire. Somebody else might have put her on medication and told her to calm down. Now, I think... what I think it comes to is this. Al Gore spoke the other night about ecology and the revolution that was triggered by Rachel Carson. I believe our only hope for the future is to adopt a new conception of human ecology, one in which we start to reconstitute our conception of the richness of human capacity. Our education system has mined our minds in the way that we've strip-mined the earth for a particular commodity, and for the future, it won't serve us. We have to rethink the fundamental principles on which we're educating our children. There was a wonderful quote by Jonas Salk, who said, if all the insects were to disappear from the earth, within 50 years, all life on earth would end. If all human beings disappeared from the earth, within 50 years, all forms of life would flourish. And he's right. What TED celebrates is the gift of the human imagination. We have to be careful now that we use this gift wisely and that we avert some of the scenarios that we've talked about. And the only way we'll do it is by seeing our creative capacities for the richness they are and seeing our children for the hope that they are. And our task is to educate their whole being so they can face this future. By the way, we may not see this future, but they will. And our job is to help them make something of it. Thank you very much.
That was Sir Ken Robinson bringing in the learning of the revolution of schools. Do kills kill creativity? Well, as we saw on the clip there, or heard from the clip, then, I mean, there are some things that schools do kill
Yeah, they do.
Things.
The first thing to go is schools running low on funds. First thing to go is music and art.
Yes.
You know, there's some things that I might... I agree with him on a lot of things, but one of the importance of keeping music and art in the schools is because they help kids learn math.
Mm, absolutely.
It can be used to assist them to learn it. Mm-hmm. So why remove it?
Yeah.
If anything, what you might want to do is remove arithmetic from the school and keep the art and music, because that'll teach them to communicate through math a lot better. but yeah, the school systems are designed to grind out answer givers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I tell you this is the answer is, now you must repeat it back to me, and that's all school really is about.
Pretty much.
It doesn't matter if it's publicly funded or private.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Doreen on the Autism Life. All right? All right, Michael?
All right.
All right, we'll be back.
Hey there. This ad caught your attention. It also caught the attention of the coolest people from Squamish to Bellingham, music fans, students, and members of various cultural communities. If you want your ad to do the same, advertise with CITR and Discorder. If you've got a rad new ad or just something you want to share, whether in print, on air, or online, promote your wares, services, or events with us. Contact us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates, information, and packages. This is the end of our ad, and if you're still here, we must be doing something right.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because, of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean... When you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture.
This is Community Living Show here on the NCRA Radio Networks and, of course, our flagship station, CITR 101.9 FM. Autism expert Dr. Doreen joins Shannon for a special episode of Ask Dr. Doreen on Autism Live. You can check all of this out on YouTube, website youtube.com. Some of the questions are like, how can I help my daughter with reading progress? Is behavior therapy effective for adults with autism? And does autism ever get any easier? For more on that, we're going to do that right now. Ask Dr. Doreen as of January 27th of 2016.
Our first question comes to us from a great CARD parent that I happen to know, who's a member of our PTA, our CARD PTA, which stands for Parents That Are Amazing, that are truly amazing, excuse me. I can't forget that. So she writes in and says, my daughter is 11 years old and is not able to read. We've tried many different reading programs, and she makes some progress and then plateaus. She's able to identify individual sounds for the letters, but is not able to blend the sounds together. She's been stuck at this stage for several years. Mm. For instance, for the word cat, she's able to sound out k-at. But instead of reading or blending the letters together to say cat, she will say some random word such as bed. Sometimes she transfers the last sound to the beginning of the word so that instead of saying cat, she may say tap. I've pushed for the school district to provide her with extra reading support, and they have used programs such as Sound Partners, and they recently switched over to Edmark Reading Program. Unfortunately, they feel that reading is not something she's capable of doing and have low expectations. They've told me many times that based on the track that my daughter is on, reading will probably not be a part of her skill set. I disagree, she writes with an exclamation point. She has worked hard to get to this point. She's able to recite many of her favorite books and song lyrics. She's able to identify CD titles from handwritten labels without any other visual cues on the CD, so I know she can memorize things when motivated. She made up a few words, some jargon that she's made up, and when I made up the corresponding spelling of those words, she picked it up immediately. If you ask her to spell Buckney, she will spell it out perfectly as if she's in a spelling bee contest. Unfortunately, I have no idea what Buckney means. And I love this mom. This is so great. At home with Card's help, we're trying to teach decoding by spelling out the words. She has individual letters and a picture of a cat, and she has to put the letter tiles together to form the word and then read the word. We're at the point where she has a visual and six letters, three letters for CBC word and three distractors. She gets it correct about 50% of the time. We've also tried just working on single word families, preferred slash familiar words, words from favorite books. I feel that we are so close, but we just haven't found the right strategy for her. Any advice or suggestions? And she says, thank you so much. And by the way, I happen to know this mom is a huge fan of yours.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you for providing all that detail. I would like to see her. And if she's a Card family, I think the best way to do this is for me to just be able to actually see this. So I don't know if you're local. If you're not, I can certainly do a FaceTime observation. So just have your supervisor contact me, and we'll get you on calendar, and I'll use your supervision funding. It doesn't matter to me. I just want to be able to delve into it. There's a lot of detail, and as you went through, I had a million different ideas, but being able to actually have a conversation with you and the supervisor and see it myself will give me some ideas of what's actually going on.
Okay. She is a couple of hours from here. I would say that. Mm-hmm. But this was one of the things that she and I had discussed, was that she can get on your schedule.
So we can totally do a FaceTime observation. I mean, I see kids in South Africa, so no problem.
And I think she could get here as well.
Sure, whichever works. We just have to get you on my calendar, which is kind of heavy.
Okay.
So we might have something in February. I don't think so. But March, I'm sure we can figure something out.
Okay.
I would love about an hour to just focus on this issue. And, you know, not to worry. And I think there's two ways to teach reading. One is memory and one is sounding out. And I'm not sure why we're doing the sounding out format, given that she has a strength with memory. So I'll find out once we meet. And also, the other issue is we might just want to really focus on words that have some sort of use to her first, rather than cat. Yeah. You know, things that are actually useful, like the things she wants. So there's certain things we can do, but let's definitely talk about it and review exactly what's going on.
Okay, wonderful. This was just an interesting question. Is the behavior therapy as effective for adults with autism?
Mm-hmm. It is. It absolutely is. We've published on this many times. Numerous people have published on the effect of ABA with adults. The reason that people focus a lot on ABA with younger children is that it's not that it's more effective, it's just that there's less to accomplish. So with a child, if you start working with a child at the age of, let's say, 2 or 3, and you're intensively working with them and teaching them, by the time they're 5 or 6 or 7, you have the ability to teach them everything they need to know to catch up to the level of a 7-year-old. But if you work with an adult, you would have to go at such a rapid pace, and you'd never really be able to teach everything they've missed in order to be able to catch up with their own age. So that's the only difference. Otherwise, so that's why with adults we focus on specific things Like, that's why these programs with adults are called focused programs, because you're focusing on what's important at that time, whether it's a vocational skill or a safety skill or whatever it is. But yeah, absolutely, the rate of acquisition is the same, and the more hours you do, the more you will learn.
I think, you know, one of the things that I've learned over the years, there's so many misconceptions about ABA and a whole lot of people who think, oh, well, it's just a treatment for autism and it's just a treatment for small children with autism. And both of those statements are wrong.
Correct.
I mean, Olympic athletes use ABA techniques.
Absolutely.
They use ABA techniques in senior citizens' homes,
right,
to change behavior. They use it in businesses, you know, corporate businesses, they use ABA techniques. And
right.
ABA was never intended to be an autism treatment. It just happens to be wildly effective for autism.
Right.
But, you know, when you start to look at it and go, oh, well, neurotypical Olympic athletes are using this as a way of getting more progress, then it just follows that it would be effective
for
adults.
Well, I mean, it's in our daily lives. We use ABA throughout the day in a loose format. So like, you know, any parent might say to their child, do your homework first and then you can get ice cream.
Right.
That's ABA. That is the exact contingency, which is I want a behavior that you will perform and then you will get a reinforcer. That's exactly the contingency. Now, lately with the development of technology, of course, we also have a lot of technology that produces those types of contingencies, such as the Fitbits, right? Or the bracelets that we wear for activity. Because what it does is it notifies you of the rate of a behavior, like let's say the number of steps you've taken.
Yes.
And it helps you to increase that by setting specific goals and telling you you've achieved X percentage of your steps. And then when you do achieve the goals, it'll give you some sort of reinforcer, which is just for adults, it's sort of like just motivation, you know, like, whoa, you achieved it, great job. I noticed with my watch, I haven't even, you know, the Apple Watch, it sort of sets it for you.
Right.
And I haven't even, like, I don't even pay attention to it all that much, but when I get days that I have fulfilled my circle, and it's really interesting how they have actually, it's not visual, like you have achieved your goal of 100%, it's a circle. And you have to complete the circle. Uh-huh. And the more steps you take, the more of the circle completes. Because human beings have this need, visual need, in our brain of closure.
Yeah.
And when you have a circle that's not completed, it goes against your need for closure.
Got it.
The way that they built it is that you gain closure, which is an automatic reinforcer.
Right.
So it's very interesting how in everything we do, there's some aspect of ABA.
Yeah.
There's so much of it. But, you know, what we do is we've taken all of those principles and very specifically brought them to the life of an individual with autism, child or adult. And it works because it simplifies things. It clarifies the contingencies in the environment. It allows them to see the connections between their own behavior and how they can bring about reward.
But I love the example because it reminds people that I think people have gotten used to seeing a couple of videos that are very DTT and they think that's what ABA is. And I think everybody needs to get a broader picture of what ABA is. And so what you see with a small child is not the same way ABA would play out with an adult.
Right.
And you just gave a perfect example that a Fitbit, That is really
absolutely
ABA technique
totally
with adults. So it just is going to look vastly, vastly different. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next question here. I have, I want to ask this one because it's very timely. Hi, Dr. Doreen. When are you going to have a social skills class in your Orange County offices? Big announcement.
Yeah, well, we have social skills programs and we're doing a pretty intense expansion of our social skills programs. We have several different social skills groups. We have a program called Camp Safari. I think we're going to change the name of that, but nevertheless, it's group social skills. And this is a big initiative across CARD. So if you apparently you're a CARD parent, please write into Shannon, let me know which office you're at, and I can give you the exact schedule of the upcoming social skills classes.
Because it's a pretty amazing expansion that's happening.
Yes, it's wonderful.
And with a really wonderful program. Okay, so somebody wrote in and said, hi, I have a 2-year-old autistic son, nonverbal. Does it ever get easier?
Gosh, I know, it's so difficult. And especially when our children are nonverbal, it's so difficult because they can't communicate and we don't know what they're trying to tell us. And so we end up reacting to them crying, I think, more than anything else, or tantruming or having a tough time. Yes, it gets easier. It gets a lot easier. And I'll tell you, it doesn't necessarily, the way that it gets easier is that you learn how to interact with your child and how to engage and how to reward and how to place demands in a way that works for the child. So what you can do to make it easier right now is just get on the IBT website, the Institute for Behavioral Training, go in the parent section and start learning some of these modules. I know it's tough when the child is asleep at night. Perhaps this is a good time to do it. They're short modules. They're not long, 20 minutes, maybe 15, maybe somewhere 30 minutes or longer. Learn these, because this is how you, this is the language of ABA. And you will learn how to interact with your child, and it'll start guiding you to how to set up contingencies that work. When the child is nonverbal, they will often not know how to communicate other than throw a tantrum. So I think this is the age where you really need to get into a comprehensive, intensive early intervention program, an ABA program. I don't know where you are. If you would write in and let us know, we can try to help. But your child has every possibility ahead of him, every opportunity ahead of him. He's only two. Please enroll him in an ABA program. There is funding for this almost everywhere in the U.S. now. So I highly recommend that you look at training yourself and then trying to get your child enrolled in an intensive program.
And we're going to leave it right there for a moment, and we're going to take a break and come back with more, unless you have something before we take a break. No, Michael?
Don't have anything right this second.
All right, so we'll be back.
Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 6th to 22nd in communities across Canada. La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series. To help celebrate Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, in 2016, 24 campus and community radio stations from across Canada produce a weekly show highlighting Rendez-vous de la Francophonie events and the importance of bilingualism and Francophone culture and history of Canada. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's this Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show. Once again.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
You tune into the Community Living Show here on CITR 101.9 FM and, of course, CNCRA Radio Networks. Kelly Rayburn along with Michael Rubin. How are you keeping so far?
Oh, I like some of what they're saying about, again, we're getting back to the stereotypes and things like that.
Oh, the autism thing.
Yeah. They're talking about behavioral rewards and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to put in two more questions onto this, and then we'll come right back with some ending to the show. All right? Okay.
We had a question. Where can a parent find a special needs car seat for a large five-year-old child? Is there any organization that helps with the cost of this item? I was saying during the break that Card recommended to us, because my son was all, and you know, I mean, he's almost 6 foot tall now, and he was always tall. And we needed a 5-point harness longer than the typical the child usual, needed. Right. And so we used a Britex. Mm-hmm. That was what Card recommended to us. They mm-hmm. are they make them taller and longer. They're humongous. It's a piece of furniture, so you have to have a card big enough to put it in. And we dragged one through an airport once. You just don't want to do that. I'm just going to tell you right now. They're heavy. They weigh like 50 pounds. So it's the kind of thing to if you have multiple cars, they're
just
not
put it
cheap.
In one. Yeah,
yeah. Get it in one or get more than one. But they're pretty incredible. They're the only ones. And as I said, Card recommended them to us. But I know that mm-hmm. Act Today, which you and I both have a little something to do with, they
would fund this. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely one of the things we would fund for sure.
Absolutely.
So write in, apply for a grant for Act Today.
Act Today. Act-today.org. I want to move on. And again, we're getting lots of condolence messages for Nancy, which I will forward. Does it make any sense to have a diagnosis of comorbid disorders with autism, such as ADHD, disruptive behavior disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, sensory integration disorder? Are they not included in autism? The DP diagnosed my son with all of the above. Now, that would be confusing to me.
It is a little confusing, and it's the first couple of years that we're allowed to do this. In the past, the original format of diagnosis was that you put a primary diagnosis on, several axes. On the primary axis, you put the primary, on the first axis, you put the primary diagnosis, and then there's like secondary axis, which used to be for longer, more chronic types of disorders, and then the third axis is medical disorders. To me, I think it has always been very valuable to have the first axis and the third axis in particular because, you know, with autism, there's so much medical stuff going on, so it's very important, and it usually gets overshadowed. Autism is one of the most it's such a pervasive disorder that it overshadows all these other disorders. So when you have autism, let's say, this is a common thing where I'll have a parent come in and say, my child's diagnosed with autism. And by the way, he has pretty significant gastrointestinal problems, but you know the GI doctor said, isn't that just, that's just part of autism. And of course it isn't, and it isn't something that should be ignored. Any kind of gastrointestinal distress has to be dealt with, regardless of the fact that the child has autism. So autism being so pervasive and so kind of confusing for people tends to overshadow all these other areas. Now, so there's part of me, you know, so there's a part of me that says, okay, it's a little scary or confusing for a parent to have all this, but it also gives a lot of information. So for instance, let's say a person could potentially just get a diagnosis of ASD. That would be fine. And then you would know from a diagnosis of ASD that this child has a lot of, let's say, limitations in social communication. And you would also know that the child has some ritualistic or sensory types of problems, you know, things that we would call self-stimulatory in nature. So those two things we know because they have a diagnosis of ASD. Now, when I have a child who also has a comorbidity with ADHD, then I know, okay, it's, you know, most cases with autism, not every case, but most cases with autism, there's a lot of attention deficit anyway. So a lot of children with autism have problems paying attention, and that's not, it's a different process. It's not because of their biochemistry necessarily, it could be, but it's also, it's just because they also have difficulty understanding language. So they don't pay attention to social cues and language because it's like gibberish to them. But having said that, when I have a diagnosis of ADHD, it's not just going to be ADHD, it's going to be ADHD, what form? So is it going to be hyperactive type, inattentive type, what type? So let's say it's ADHD combined types. Then I know for sure this child also has a lot of hyperactivity and a lot of inattention issues. Then I have disruptive behavior disorder and oppositional defiant disorder. Those two don't really mean much to me because with autism, what happens is that you can't communicate, therefore problem behaviors or challenging behaviors become your form of communication. So you tend to be disruptive, you tend to be oppositional because you don't understand what demands are being made and you don't know how to express yourself.
It's a normal reaction.
It's a normal reaction. Anyone, if you couldn't communicate, when someone told you to do something that you didn't want to do, and you couldn't say, I don't want to do this right now, you would hit, run away, tantrum, all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in fact, in our adult lives, when we tantrum or have meltdowns, it's because of the same reasons. It's frustration, and we can never express ourselves. So those two, to me, don't give me a lot because I know autism really well, and I know that any child with autism will have some level of disruptive behavior and oppositional defiance. So that's that. The sensory integration disorder, you know, this is the first time that we have autism has a subdivision. One of the symptom criteria in the second domain of autism has sensory dysregulation, which is great. It's the first time ever. But having it in there, it's just, you know, for those people who don't know autism well enough,
yeah,
it helps you identify, oh, this child has some sensory issues. We should deal with those too. So in that sense, autism might be kind of overarching. And I've said that in the past, that like having a diagnosis of something like ADHD and autism isn't all that helpful. But it for a lot of people who don't know what autism can encompass, it is helpful. So don't take it as sort of a, oh my God, my child has five different things going on. Rather, the symptoms have been highlighted, and it's a good thing because A, it will lead to more funding. B, professionals will pay attention to all of those things rather than just considering the child, you know, globally autistic and that's that. They will pay attention to the sensory. They will pay attention to the inattention, to the oppositional stuff. You know, they'll pay attention to each aspect and realize, okay, we got to help all these things and we can't ignore any single area. So those are the benefits. Don't let it discourage you. In essence, yes, you could have avoided all of these because autism does kind of include all of these.
Okay, great. I'm going to move on to a question that came in live.
Actually, we're going to finish off right now. So, anyways, if you want any more information on this as well, they also have a Autism Live on Facebook, facebook.com/AutismLive. And you can also visit the card, which is the Center for Autism and Related Disorders that is headquartered in Woodland Hills, California. Their website is centerforautism.com. Of course, you are listening to the Community Living Show here on the NCRE Radio Networks and, of course, our flagship station, CITR 101.9 FM. Of course, this is it for me.
Why don't we play that video real quick, and because it's only going to take about 5 minutes, and that'll take us most of the way out.
Sure. Okay, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to be doing in the next month of February. Anyways.
Okay.
Here we go.
All right.
What is fibromyalgia? It is a medical disorder characterized by chronic widespread pain and heightened painful response to pressure. Fibromyalgia literally means muscle and connective tissue pain. The warning signs and symptoms of fibromyalgia are stiffness, especially in the morning, joint and muscle pain all over the body, trouble sleeping at night, a feeling of being tired all the time. Other symptoms that may follow are difficulty swallowing, bowel and bladder abnormalities. Along with these symptoms may come depression and anxiety and stress-related disorders. When is the onset of fibromyalgia? It can occur at any age. While 80 to 90% are women, men and children can also be afflicted. It affects some 48,000 people in British Columbia alone.
As when we're walking through the cities and they see our shirts that say this, I'm hoping that people that do have some kind of fibromyalgia or some kind of an illness, that they've come out to go shopping, but that's the only thing they do in their life. They never go anywhere. They just stay at home. That they'll see us walking, and maybe it'll be an incentive for them to get out and do more. because this is what we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to accomplish people to not just hide away, to come out.
I only have fibromyalgia today. Take one day at a time. One of the best ways to treat fibromyalgia is lifestyle management. You may also have to make changes in the way you approach life and your diet.
Okay, for those of you who don't know, I have a neck injury that goes back to when I was 15. And 2 years ago, I was not able to walk again. I couldn't move my head up at all. I couldn't hold it up. I was very ill. Marion remembers that. And they had to have a babysitter because I couldn't do anything on my own. This was only 2.5 years ago. And one thing my husband and I, Nigel's my husband, if you didn't know that. And he has put up with me. It's pretty challenging. he knows I couldn't raise my head. And you know, I was diagnosed at 40. I was in a wheelchair at 40. And I was diagnosed then that I had rheumatoid arthritis. And one of the things that go when you have rheumatoid arthritis is the muscles. And that was the first thing I thought of when I woke up and I couldn't move my head and I couldn't lift it. And I thought to myself, well, I guess it's the rheumatoid arthritis is now here. This is it. And the first thing I thought of, instead of feeling sorry for myself, which is, I'm not saying I'm a saint. I do feel sorry for myself sometimes. Not very often. And I put Christmas music and stuff on. Anyways, I said to myself, you know what? Christopher Reeve can do it. I can do something too. And then it was a long road. I still have to go to my, especially, that's why he's in there, Dr. Freund. He keeps my head up, okay? Because I have a condition the rest of my life that I'm going to be lucky to keep that head up. And you know what? If I can walk, anyone can walk. Because one of the questions is, well, you know, one of the things, and I know you're all do it in here, is we have handicap stickers, right? And we park sometimes on our bad days in the handicap parking. And how many of you look around you and think, I need that cane, just pretend I need that cane today? That's wrong. That makes me mad. And when I get angry, why should we have to prove we're disabled? We still are people. We are allowed to be alive. We're allowed to walk.
This is the end of the video, and at this time, we would like for you to donate what you can.
And okay.
So, of course, that's featuring Cheryl Young and the board members of the Fibromyalgia Wellspring. Mm-hmm. And if you go to GoFundMe, it's GoFundMe. .com/just1more step 2016, and you will find their GoFundMe. Help them out. They're walking from Langley to Banff.
Interesting.
Yep.
And I will be away too. Yeah, Cambodia.
Cambodia. That's exciting.
Yeah. So I'm going to be doing two tasks over there. One is a woman who's about in her 50s has not, and of course this is, we're going to be helping with the repairs. So that's what I'm going to be doing. Going to be helping out with, in Cambodia, just helping out with the walls and just fixing up some of the repairs of the house. So that's for the first part of it. And then of course the second part of the build is we're going over to a school where we're going to be helping build a big, I don't know, water container, mm-hmm. Some sort of big container, because the school doesn't even have big water supplies and stuff. So those are the two projects I'm going to be helping out throughout that week. And who knows, I might have a surprise and might phone you.
There you go.
Check out on the project and stuff. So stay tuned.
awesome. Sounds like you're going to have a lot of fun and get some real work done for our global community.
Absolutely. So that is our show for today, and hopefully we will be back again next week with Michael. So stay tuned for upcoming shows that are in your area, and we'll be back again next week. Anyways, take care.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.